Rock Sugar Magic is brought to you by Florida Boy, Inc. If you like Duck Dynasty or Swamp People, you'll love what Florida Boy has cooking up. It's Florida Boy, Inc., Florida Boy, Inc. on Instagram. Head over there and tell them we sent you.
Chris Voss, welcome to Rock Sugar Magic.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
I am so happy you're here. For people that don't know you, you're quite extraordinary. I mean, you were a hostage negotiator, a kidnapping negotiator for the FBI.
Right.
You are a best-selling author. You're a businessman. You're an academic. You do a lot of things. I'm fascinated with you. I watched you. I was on a Delta flight for 5 hours coming back from Florida. I take that flight all the time. And I'm just looking, you know, for something to watch. And then I see Masterclass, Chris Voss, teaches the art of negotiation. And I'm like, what is this?
All right.
Yeah. So I just hit play and I watched the entire thing. So I'm like, I have to get you on the show.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Delta. Thank you, Masterclass.
Right? It's so good. I went and bought Masterclass because I didn't know. It's like, what is this? So I went, and then you have to have a subscription.
Right.
So they have really cool stuff on there.
Yeah.
But I got back from watching that and I made my boyfriend and my roommate. I'm like, you got to watch this guy. This is so amazing. You got it. And then we're like practicing. I'm like mirroring.
Yeah.
So my boyfriend kept mirroring me.
Yeah. All right. Good.
Yeah. It was awesome. How did you get into this?
I mean, you know, I grew up in Iowa. How did I get into which part?
The hostage negotiation, how did you learn that? Talking to people who've kidnapped people, talking to like some of the, like, worst terrorists in the world.
Yeah, well, first of all, I naively thought, you know, how hard could it be? I was on a SWAT team with the FBI, trying out for FBI's hostage rescue team, and re-injured my knee and had knee surgery again. And then I knew that, having been on a SWAT team when we went out, the negotiators were all always there, and they talked to people, and I genuinely thought, yeah, I could talk to terrorists. How hard could it be? I like to say that's similar to Redneck's famous last words, hey, watch this. But I grew up in a small town, blue collar environment in Iowa, and my father always wanted us to figure stuff out. And so can't be that hard. And initially then, when I decided that I should be a hostage negotiator, I went to the woman who was the head of the team in New York, and she was suitably unimpressed with me. I had absolutely no credentials whatsoever other than that I wanted to do it. And she pretty much pointed that out to me. She said, I know who you are. I know you were a cop. Were you a negotiator as a cop? And I'm like, no. She said, you got a degree in psychology? No. Have you any background in therapy, counseling, anything? I said, no. And she said, well, no, you can't do it. Go away. Don't bother me. Everybody wants to do it. Everybody thinks it sounds easy. You're not qualified. And so I said, well, there's got to be something I could do. What could I do? She said, yeah, go ahead. There is. Go volunteer on a suicide hotline. Now until you have, don't bother me.
Wow.
And I took her advice, which shocked her, and it shocked me that it shocked her, because I thought, you know, you ask somebody what you should do, ask the right person, of course. The key issue is, are you asking the right person? But then you got to do it. In the FBI, I remember new agents were famous for what we called shopping for opinions. You know, somebody new in a squad would walk in and ask you what you should do. They already knew what they wanted to do, and they just keep shopping until and if they didn't hear what they liked, then they didn't do anything.
Isn't that like somebody, like a friend who constantly does the same thing but asks everybody for advice but then takes their own?
And does nothing, right, yeah. Unfortunately, it's actually asking the right person and then doing what you're told is so rare that if you do it, you've immediately 10 times passed everybody else, which was what happened with me.
How long were you on that suicide line for?
I was involved with the suicide hotline in total for about 3 years. I volunteered regularly for about two and a half years, and then I got on their board of directors, and ultimately, before I left, I was chair of the board because it was cool. I was dedicated to it. It was very satisfying.
How How did you learn to talk to people who are on the edge of suicide?
You know, it's actually listening is magical, and that's what they teach you to do, because nobody actually listens. You know, actual emotional intelligence, actual empathy. For example, empathy is being equated to sympathy in today's vernacular, and it has for so long that the first thing they did was set out and say, this is not sympathy, this is empathy. Right. And they'd say, sympathy is when someone's in quicksand, you get into quicksand with them. And so then you both drown.
Yeah.
And they made a very clear distinction. And then the crazy thing about empathy and actually listening is it's astonishingly fast. You start out in your training on the suicide hotline, and they say, by the way, there's going to be a 20-minute time limit on all calls. And your initial reaction is like, what, you got to be kidding me. I've heard about people trying to talk somebody out of being suicidal, and it takes all night.
Yeah.
And they say, well, not if you do it properly. And as a matter of fact, if you do it right, it'll take less than 20 minutes. And that's, number one, the power of actually listening to people. And number two, the fact that nobody does. So you are immediately so different in a person's mind when you're actually listening, not judging, not contradicting, not explaining, but actually being a great sounding board and then offering them insight. Yeah. To what you hear, it's ridiculously quick, and it is just the best description I can have for it is it's astonishing. Like, people that are watching don't see it. It's invisible. And the person who it's being used with, and notice I avoided the term on,
yeah,
they don't know, but suddenly they're transformed. We've got, we're here in Vegas, and one of the guys now is coaching and training for me, former Vegas Metro Police Department, and is still doing some cold case work for them, but has drastically changed since he started working with us, even though he was on the Vegas Metro negotiation team.
Yeah.
He's telling me a story the other day. He gets tasked with finding this woman a million-dollar fraud. And he's got to serve a subpoena on her. And they're gonna, if she accepts service of the subpoena, she's gonna be held accountable for this million-dollar fraud. So he's got a pretty good line on where he thinks she is. He's talking through a Ring doorbell to the woman that he thinks is who he's looking for. She's not admitting it's her. And it's a Ring doorbell, so he's talking to her in Vegas. She could be in Alaska.
Sure.
But he starts using empathy the way that we use it, and his description is he makes it all about her. So she's been on the run for months avoiding subpoena for $1 million. 2 days later, he's meeting her in a coffee shop, and she's accepting service.
To accept service when they're on the run. You're talking to them through the Ring. Give me a couple of zingers. Like, what kind of empathy are you using? How are you making it all about her?
Well, how what would they say out loud? And everybody knows what somebody would say out loud. We just think, since that makes no sense, I'm not even going to utter it. So what would she, what's in the back of her mind? What would she say out loud? This isn't fair. These people took advantage of me. I'm just a regular human being, and this is not my fault. So he starts saying to her, like, look, this doesn't seem fair to you. This seems like the world is taking advantage of you. To you, you seem like someone who's being treated unfairly. You know, what are the excuses going through somebody's mind? What's the voice in their head telling them about the situation? What a lot of people miss about empathy, it's not about the truth. It's not about accuracy. It's not about fairness. It's about how the other person sees it. What are they saying to themselves about this? And so if your first gut instinct, like, well, if I say what they're saying to themselves, it only reinforce it and cause them to dig in their mind, in their brain, and be worse and be even more convinced. And it doesn't. It has the exact opposite effect. I think, which is why so few people do it, because they're afraid that it's going to make things worse. And secondarily, you don't see it happen in a moment. There's no big celebratory moment or the victory in the moment. You don't vanquish your opponent, or the other person doesn't fall into your arms sobbing because you pointed out the truth.
Right.
There's an invisible transformation, and either 10 minutes later or 2 days later, you're astonished at how you suddenly got into this conversation. And this guy's name is Don. He's talking through a Ring doorbell one day, and the person's not even admitting that it's them. She's not copping to that he's talking to the right person, or that she even knows the right person.
Right.
And 2 days later, he's sitting in a coffee shop, and she's voluntarily accepting the subpoena. It's astonishing.
It really is. And I've taken communications courses, and I'm a talk radio host. And I'm thinking, well, how can I get better? But you can. You can get better at everything.
Yeah.
And it's not, people say, well, it's, you know, there's certain things like NLP and things that seems manipulative, but this isn't. When you actually listen to somebody
right. And
you hear them, like you're mirroring, you end with somebody's last words, or you're really hearing them. People aren't used to that. They're not
right. Used
to being heard.
Right.
And when you let them know they're being heard, it changes everything. And I had this roommate once who was fighting with her best friend, and they were just, I mean, it was just really awful. And then it got to texting, and they were going after her. I said, would you like to stop it? Would you like her to just, she had done something wrong, and then they'd gotten into this whole thing. Take responsibility. Just take responsibility for whatever you can. And I said, I'm going to text her. I'm going to text her two sentences, and she's going to call you up and apologize and tell you, no, it's me. It was like, hey, I'm sorry. Sometimes I can do things like that, and I don't mean it. And, I'm sorry. I can sometimes be a bad friend, and I apologize. I love you. Boom, within, called her back. I'm sorry. It's me. It was my fault. She's like, how did you do that? I just take responsibility. Listen to what she's saying.
Yeah.
What can you take responsibility for?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I've just learned so many things. Instead of fighting with somebody, you just listen, repeat back what they're saying. Really let them know that you're hearing them, and the conversation will go from like 10 to like 2, and you can talk.
And a subtle difference in what you just said also, to let somebody know that you're hearing them, you don't say, I understand. Yeah. You say what they're thinking.
Yeah.
Because even if you do understand, they don't actually know what you understand. So you got to lay it out and then let them say to themselves, you understand.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's right, exactly what you did with that text.
Yeah, and it's just so, it's amazing. People are like, how do you do that? I'm like, I just really listen, and I give back. And when I saw you doing that, I didn't know you have names for things and yeah. These techniques that are so simple, yet so powerful. Can we talk a little bit about that? Like about, from your
happy
master
to.
Class?
Yeah, of course.
It's so
yeah. Good.
The mirroring.
Yes, the mirroring?
Yeah. So you were talking, there was a story you told about a guy who learned how to mirror, basically what you just did. And he went to this yoga retreat. Can you talk about that? Because that was great.
That guy was great. All right. So my son Brandon and I are teaching negotiation at a yoga retreat, which is an interesting context to contemplate. But we were anyway. And, my son's a big, big guy. He's rather large human being, college football player, big boy, much bigger than me. Although I often say it's just a light that he looks bigger.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're talking to this guy in his conversation. And early on, I could tell he's got this happy, silly look on his face. And everybody's talking to him. Everybody loves him, except his wife is glaring at him constantly. And I realized that about 45 minutes into the conversation, the only thing this guy's doing is mirroring. He's mirroring us. He's mirroring everybody around him. And I enjoy being mirrored. And, so he did it for quite a while before I figured it out. And then I catch on that he's doing nothing but mirroring.
And tell people exactly what that is.
Well, mirroring is repeating 1 to 3-ish words. It's often the last 1 to 3. Could be one word, could be never more than 5. But repeating pretty much verbatim what they've just said. And it feels really good to be mirrored. It's great. It's the better thing to do instead of what do you mean by that? For a variety of reasons. Hits the brain very differently, causes people to reword and expand. And typically, if you say to somebody, what do you mean by that? They just say it again, only louder.
Right.
And it encourages conversation. Like if you're good at it with great inflection, you could go through days and do nothing but mirror, which is what this guy's doing. Now, we realized after the fact what happened was he told his wife in advance that he was only going to mirror. He learned it from our techniques. He read the book, saw how powerful it was. And he says, you watch. We're going to be there for 2 days, and I'm going to do nothing but mirror people. And people are falling all over themselves, but his wife's glaring at him because he told her that that was what he was going to do.
Yeah.
And all the women at the yoga retreat were coming up to her going, your husband is so interesting. Oh, my God. He's such a brilliant conversationalist. We love him so much. Make sure you bring him back whenever you come back. And he's having the best time because also he knows it's annoying his wife.
Yeah. Great. And you had that with your son. Like there was something, I think your son was not understanding and you got louder.
Yeah, I'm of the three conflict negotiation types, fight, flight, make friends, assertive, analyst, accommodator. I'm an assertive, so I have a tendency to repeat only louder.
Yeah.
I don't watch myself.
Right, right. Because it's not, I mean, it really is a skill.
It's practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You drill
Simple
it.
Skill. You drill it.
Yeah.
It's a perishable skill. All the skills are perishable, but they're fun to practice.
Yeah. Yeah, my boyfriend was doing it to me. I was telling you that. It was so funny because I was going along with it, and I'm like, oh
he's got
my
you.
Gosh. And it was interesting. He was really listening. And sometimes I'll say, you don't listen to me, or you're not, like, you're gone. I'm talking to you and I don't feel like you're getting it. And he started to do that. I'm like, oh, that, wait a second. You're mirroring me. He goes, yeah. And he would do it. He hasn't done it in a little while, but he would do it a few weeks after we watched you.
Mm.
And I really liked it.
It does. It feels good.
Yeah.
And first of all, and you have to actually be listening to mirror.
Yeah.
And then you give the conversation right back to the other person. It's not an interruption. Like he mirrors you, then he's waiting for you to respond and go on instead of interrupting, taking over the conversation. Like there's so many reasons why it's a great skill.
Yeah. No, it's awesome. Can you tell me, there was a great story you told about the Chase Bank.
Chase Bank, yeah.
Yeah, the hostage negotiation situation.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and then the mirroring aspect of that, too, is if you practice how to mirror, it's great for when you're really caught off guard. Like, you don't know where to go with this. Like, I don't know. I'm flummoxed right now.
Right.
And actually, I had a conversation earlier today. Guy's telling me he's got this big move planned literally from one country to another country. And the day before, his love of his life, his spouse, his bride comes in. She says, we got to cancel the move. And, you know, they're moving to another country. And, you know, he's like, got to cancel the move? And he immediately digs in and finds out what's going on and solves the problem. But initially, like if you're planning on moving from one country to another and you've got the move in the works for months, if not years, and a day before your significant other comes in and says, we got to cancel the move, you're like, where do I begin?
What do you say to that? Except a mirror. You got to,
Because you're so caught off guard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what happened at the Chase Bank was I'm the second negotiator up. Situation is stable threat-wise for about 5 hours. Bad guy's been trying to conceal his identity. We've managed to find out who he is. We're going to switch negotiators, and we're not going to do a traditional handoff. I'm just going to dive right in. No explanation. I'm just going to start talking to him. And then Hugh McGowan, commander of the NYPD, said, yeah, I want you to dive right in, and first chance, we're going to confront him on his name. Which is not something you would do right away, but we've been stable for 5 hours, so it's a safe thing to do. And I'm not ready to hit him right away, so I'm going to back into how we figured out who he was, which is we've identified his van outside, ran a license plate, brought somebody to the scene that knows him, listened to him on the speaker, and they said, yeah, that's him. So I start out, and I go, listen, you know, we got this van outside. And he's catching on right away, very manipulative guy.
So how many hostages were there in the bank?
There were three hostages. There were two female tellers and a bank guard. The weird thing at the time, we didn't know how many bad guys there were. we're under the impression there are about seven or eight. There are actually only two. So lieutenant puts me on a phone, and I start backing into how we got his ID. And he blurts something out. He said, we got more than one vehicle. And I was just, I didn't know what to do with that. So I said, you got more than one vehicle? He says, yeah, we only have one vehicle. And I said, you only have one vehicle? And then he says, because you chased my driver away. And again, I'm just confused. And I said, we chased your driver away? He goes, yeah, when he saw the police, he cut and run. Now, the getaway driver had been out front, and when the police showed up sooner than they expected, trapped the bad guys inside, like, he took off. Now, at that point in time, we have no information whatsoever to there being a getaway driver that got away. And then further on down the line, when they got ready to take this thing to trial, I run into the case agent from the bank robbery squad, and he says, yeah, we're going to have to let the getaway driver get away because there's no evidence. And I said, no. Right in the middle of the transcript, our main bad guy identifies him and talks about him. And he had the transcript, but it was nearly 12 hours of conversation. He didn't know that was in the middle of it. And I had the tapes transcribed, so I went and I got them, and I showed it to him, and he went, and they put the transcript down in front of the getaway driver's defense attorney, who was threatening to take him to trial because they had no evidence.
Yeah.
And when they handed him the transcript, they agreed to plead guilty.
Because there was only one driver, and you figured out what the van was, right?
Yeah.
And his name. Right?
And our bad guy tied him to the crime verbally, voluntarily, spontaneously. Wow. So it was completely admissible.
Rock Sugar Magic is brought to you by Tequila Comisario. Elevate your tequila experience with award-winning Tequila Comisario. Crafted with 100% all-natural agave, it's handcrafted and known to create tequila connoisseurs. Tequila Comisario is one of only six tequilas in the world to receive the coveted Platinum Award. Experience the best tequila in the world. Tequila Comisario.
So you're talking to this guy, and I know it was very interesting. You knew his name, but he kept saying it wasn't him.
He wouldn't give us a name. And finally, I made the mistake. You're always going to make mistakes.
Yeah.
So I said, the registration of the van is to Chris Watts.
Right.
And he says, okay. Now, the mistake I made was to ask him a yes-oriented question for admission. And I said, so is that you? And he's like, no. You know, no is always the default answer.
Yeah.
So you just got to fix your question. But no is the way to defend. And what I should have said, I should have said, which I learned in subsequent interviews, I should have said, look, I know you're Chris Watts.
Right.
Instead of asking him. And we would clear that. But I made the mistake of asking a yes-oriented question. I mean, you make mistakes. And ultimately, then he gets rattled and hands the phone off to his counterpart inside. And to this day, I still don't know why he handed it off or why the other guy took it.
You don't think he got nervous that you mentioned his name?
Well, I'm sure he did. I just never had the opportunity to ask either one of them what was going on inside. What were you guys thinking? I could speculate that he was rattled and he needed to buy time, and he figured that if he handed the phone to his buddy, that it would give him more time to figure a way out. And he handed the phone off, and the guy handed the phone off to surrender to me about 90 minutes later, personally, face-to-face out in front of the bank. And then, of course, you know, we interviewed him afterwards. He says, yeah, you know, there's only one other guy in the bank, and this is what his name is. And then the next negotiator on the phone, a guy named Dominic, NYPD guy, brilliant closer. Like, Dominic, I've always thought, was one of the world's greatest closers. And Dominic gets on the phone with this guy, and he says, look, you know, we got Bobby. We got one of the hostages. We know who you are. And all Dominic wants to do is call him by his first name, to just try to establish some sort of a connection because we want to get the guy out alive.
Right.
And even when Dominic says all this to him, he says, what do you want me to call you? Now, we had tagged him earlier with the name of Bobby. No, Billy. We were calling him Billy. And he says, call me Billy, which is not his name. But Dominic is sharp enough to know, like, we got him.
Yeah.
We're not going to get into an argument over what we're going to call him because that's just going to set us back.
Sure.
So Dominic's like, all right, I'll call you Billy. And about 5 hours after that, he was coming out.
So you had, but I know that they released one of the hostages.
Right.
Prior.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other two, everybody came out alive and uninjured?
Everybody was out. And, you know, the hostage release, the other interesting thing, which I learned about bad guys, was a manipulation. It wasn't concession. Mm. We got one of the bad guys out, and our main bad guy, his first name was Chris. So, you know, obviously a smart guy.
Yeah. That's the Chris Watts.
It's a good, good name. No matter what, he's got to feel like he's got the upper hand, and he's got to not go along with what we want. So we've got his co-conspirator out, and we're pressuring him to come out, and he's got to buy time without raising the threat level. He was very good at all times of not giving us a reason to shoot him.
Yeah.
He's very careful about that.
Yeah.
So what's the best way to keep the authorities from either breaking down a door or shooting you? If you got multiple hostages, let one go.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's going to chill. We got hostages coming out. We're not going to need violence to solve this. And a great way to de-escalate, if you have spare hostages, is to let one go. And I applied that lesson in subsequent cases. Got a really manipulative guy on the inside. If you gently make him worry about an assault, and he's got multiple hostages, the best way to keep you from assaulting is to let somebody go.
Sure.
And this is exactly what the main bad guy does. He's got to buy time. He's got three hostages. I got spares. I'll let one walk out the door. That's going to buy me time. And it did.
Yeah. And what was Billy's real name?
Chris Watts.
Oh, that was Billy, Chris Watts.
Billy and
okay,
Chris.
Okay, who was the other guy then?
Is a gentleman named Bobby Goodwin.
So it was Bobby and Chris.
Yeah.
Okay. So I didn't know that Chris was Billy. I thought it was the other guy.
Yeah. Well, of course, the ringleader's name was Chris.
Yeah. Have you ever lost a negotiation? Have you
of
ever
course.
Lost, like, where there was death involved?
Oh, yeah, of course.
What was the worst?
Oh, they were all bad.
The most harrowing, the one that you had, I guess, the most into, the most time, the most...
Well, the first time somebody got killed in a case that I was working, a Bernard Sabero case in the Philippines. It's about 2001, 2002-ish time frame. And a lot of, you know, the bad guys, really bad guys, Abu Sayyaf terrorist group in the southern Philippines, they killed a number of Filipinos along the way. They're really vicious, bloodthirsty group, marauders. And then ultimately...
Marauders, meaning?
Well... you know, some you might think of terrorists as, you know, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. There's a lot of truth to that. But these guys were just bad guys that liked to murder and rape and loot and maraud in the south of the Philippines.
Okay.
And so they catch on that and get a lot of money from kidnapping. A rival gang had kidnapped some Western hostages in a dive resort in Malaysia, which is just across the border over the ocean. And it ultimately scored about $20 million.
Yeah, 4 or 5 hour plane flight. I used to live in Singapore.
Okay,
yeah,
there
yeah,
you go.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you find out how lucrative kidnapping could be, you turn into a mercenary. Like even Al-Qaeda, when they found out how lucrative kidnapping could be, they're doing it for the money. I've never seen any group that started out political terrorist in nature that as soon as they found out how much money they could make from kidnapping turned into mercenaries. Never seen one that didn't.
Wow.
Like, you know, everybody wants the bling,
yeah.
No matter who you are.
Yeah.
corruption by money is, if you throw enough money at people, it's almost universal. So anyway, these thugs in the south of the Philippines discover that they could get a lot of money. They hit another dive resort. They murder an American. They murder a number of Filipinos right off the bat. They murder an American about 3 weeks in.
Do they take them and, like, hold them? Is this just they killed them and said, we're going to do it just for them to have some kind of power? Or why would they just murder and not hold that hostage and ask for money?
They're looking to make a point at various points along the
way.
Right,
okay, so. All right.
And as they're literally marauding through the south of Philippines, you got to understand how the other side sees it. And the other side sees it very cold-hearted. And they take human beings and they reduce them to commodities.
Yeah.
And a replacement of the commodities. And the commodity that they could easily replace at the time, as they're marauding through the Philippines, they're picking up new hostages as they're killing other hostages. They're not killing the Americans because they started out, they only had three of them. But then they decide they want to make a point and they select one and they behead them about 3 weeks in.
They make a video of this?
They did not. And as a matter of fact, for the longest time, there was no evidence that they'd done it other than their word. And we assessed them the way they were talking about it, that they'd actually done it. But since it took some time before his remains were found, it was in question for quite a while as to whether or not he was actually dead in some people's minds. So then we're about 11 or so months into what was ultimately a 13-month case. Had negotiated, family representatives were allowed to negotiate a ransom for the release of their family. Ransom was delivered in a bag as didn't let the hostages go. And so then it just got uglier slowly for about a month, month and a half. And finally it was resolved with a botched rescue attempt. A squadron of Filipino scout rangers stumbled over the terrorist encampment that was holding the hostages. Didn't know that there were hostages there, but immediately recognized it as a terrorist camp and just opened fire.
Oh, Lord.
And most of the bad guys were killed. Martin Burnham was shot and killed, and his wife, Gracia, was wounded through the leg, and she survived and lives to this day. So that was the first time I'd been in a case where I'd been directly involved in people who got killed. And that was, you know, they're all really bad when it happens, but the reality is it does. Hostage negotiation, no negotiation has 100% success rate. And if it doesn't have 100% success rate, hostage negotiation is about 93. Some people would say 94. That means that anytime you start climbing past double digits, just based on the reality of how tough life is, things are going to go bad. And I worked a lot of cases, so things went bad.
And what about the, this is one that went well. I thought this was very interesting. Somebody that was a reporter, I think, and she was going in and, was it Iran?
Jill Carroll in Iraq? Yeah, that was a great
Iraq,
case.
Iraq. That was amazing. So this woman goes to Iraq. She's a reporter.
Right.
She gets taken.
Right.
And she's, you know, she's not wearing a hijab or any kind of, right, her hair is not covered.
Her hair was covered when they grabbed her, but I do know the first video they did, it wasn't.
Right. And can you talk about that one? That one blew my mind, what you did and how you came up with what to tell the dad that ultimately saved her life.
Yeah. All negotiations, Jim Camp in his book 2002, just talking about business, said you got to negotiate in your adversary's world. And that's essentially what empathy is. Not how do I see it, but how do you see it?
Right.
And I need to dial into how you see it, which makes cross-cultural negotiations very easy. And it's a little bit, what's the price of admission? Price of admission is respect. Respecting the other side. Now, you're not going to know the culture completely right off the bat, but if you're respectful, they'll allow you to make mistakes and that you want to learn, respect, deference, learning. You can dial into them very quickly. So in the Jill Carroll case, they grab her. We don't really know who's behind it. She disappears. It's at a period of time when Al-Qaeda's grabbing people. And if Al-Qaeda's got you, things look really, really bad.
Yeah.
So they put up a video of her, and the video, we assess the images in the video as extremely high threat level. They've judged her. They've got people standing around her holding books as if they're judging her. And if someone is judged by God, then you didn't murder them. You executed them. Executioners are not guilty of murder. Every country that has a death penalty, you don't convict the executioner,
right.
The guy that pulls a switch, whatever they do. In all societies, an execution carried out with the blessing of a higher authority is not a murder. So they've made it look like they could execute her. Very high threat level in a video. So, and also she's pictured in the video with her hair uncovered.
Yeah.
So we start to shoot messages back through the media on a number of levels, not the least of which, to start with, we said they disrespected her by their rules. She's in their custody, so she's not responsible for the fact that her hair wasn't covered. They are. They put her on camera, and they disrespected her, and they disrespected their own culture by allowing her to be depicted that way. What are their rules? What negotiate in your adversary's world? How do they see it? How do they look at it? We also know at the time that in their world, respect in a family flows from the father.
Yeah.
So we're generating statements to be made in the media, and the father's very culturable, and her mother and her sister are not particularly culturable. They want to say Jill is innocent, Jill is this, Jill is that, let her go. All the predictable dialogue, number one, that's predictable. Number two, isn't terribly respectful of them.
Mm-hmm.
If I accuse you of holding someone that's innocent, then I'm judging you.
Right. You're making them wrong.
Right. Yeah. I'm making you wrong.
Yeah.
Not a great way to establish rapport or influence.
Right.
So we talk to her dad. Her dad's very coachable. And we say, all right, what we want you to do is we want you to say things that are inarguably true. What's inarguably true? It's inarguable that she's not their enemy. Innocence is a value of judgment. But it's inarguable they got a lot of enemies. She wasn't on the enemy's list. It's inarguable that she's there reporting what's really going on in Iraq. She's not a propaganda. She's Jill was here to tell your story about what's really happening. Jill is not your enemy. If you release her, she can continue to tell the story that's true. So we talk about him. We lay out to him what we think is going to be effective and why. It's completely at his option whether or not he says it. It makes sense to him. He buys into all of it. Mm-hmm. We discuss with American media, and everybody's got problems with media. While I was doing that job, I never had any problems with anyone in the media because we negotiated very tightly up front what we wanted. And I said, all right, here's what we'll give you. We'll give you exclusive access that no one else in the world has to film Jill Carroll's father. He's going to make a statement. You don't get to ask him any questions. If you want to ask him questions, you don't get the interview. Here's a game plan.
Yeah.
Nobody in the media ever double-crossed me on any upfront agreement.
I mean, you're an FBI negotiator, and if they were to ask a question that could make it go south, they're responsible in some way for her death.
Theoretically, but, you know, not everybody always sees it that way. And most likely, they're going to stick to the script.
Right.
But we did it a lot. There were times when I forgot to mention stuff, and then if it went sideways, if they didn't do what I said, they'd say, well, you didn't say we couldn't do that. And it wasn't really within the scope of what you asked for. And I'd have to admit, yeah, very correct. But we had two conditions. Number one, you don't get to ask him any questions. Number two, you got to feed it as is directly into the Middle Eastern media. Mm-hmm. They'll pick it up if you give it to them because it's exclusive. Because they won't get it otherwise. You know, media around the world, everybody wants to have the scoop. They're going to go right. First, give them the conditions, they're going to go with it. So anyway, we do her father's statement. Everybody complies. And the very next video of Jill, number one, her hair is covered. and there aren't any executioners in the picture. So they've gone from
the judgment. So he basically said exactly what you said.
Said exactly what we said.
So, like, she's there to cover a story.
She's like, not your enemy.
She's not your enemy. And did they say, look, you're disrespecting her? Did they say that by not covering her? Did
he
say that?
He didn't say that. Okay. Now, we put that broadly through all our other contacts.
Okay.
But that sort of judgmental thing wouldn't have helped for him to
say.
That's
what I was thinking, yeah. Right.
So we left that out. But we did, through all the other intermediaries, we said they disrespected her.
Yeah.
So we've got it working on a number of levels. We go from a high threat level video to a video that's just trying to be appealing.
Yeah.
Humanizing her. And then there was yet a third video that was even more appealing and humanized her even more. And as soon as we got the second video, we don't know what's going on, but we're like, all right, we got, you know, this is heading the right direction.
Yeah. Because she's not dead yet.
She's not only is she not dead, but they're not escalating the threat.
Okay.
And not making any deadlines. They're not allowing themselves to be backed into a corner. A deadline would have been a bad thing. And if they'd have laid a deadline on it, it would have been very bad. So they don't do anything bad, and it actually is better. We find out afterwards in the debriefs of her that as soon as they saw her father, they came to her and said, your father's an honorable man. Now, at that point in time, the shield of honor from her father has been placed around her, and they can't hurt her. They can't touch her if they say to her, your father is an honorable man. They still haven't figured out how to get out of it.
Right,
and ultimately, she appears approximately, I think it was about 88 days later, she appears on the streets in Baghdad, very close to where she was taken.
And they just let her go.
I have no follow-up information to other than the fact that they just let her go.
Wow. But she didn't know at the time that when they said, your father is an honorable man, that she was safe. Did she have any clue to that?
No, I'm sure she had to have felt a difference in the way she was being treated.
Yeah.
I'm sure there was a tremendous amount of tension that was eased. While you're still there, plus anybody's been kidnapped for, if you've been kidnapped at all and moved, traumatic stress is already set in.
Yeah.
If you've been moved at all, let alone if you've been held for 30 days.
Yeah.
So your ability to really sense what's going on at the time in the moment is going to be inaccurate. I have no doubt. I've never spoken to her since. I haven't seen any follow-up interviews. I have no doubt that at the time she sensed that she was much safer.
Well, did she write about it?
There was some follow-up journalism stories that were done with her. Some people interviewed her. She didn't write about it that I've seen. I was still with the FBI for a couple more years, so they have a tendency to keep you out of the media while you're there. It's at the time it's frustrating, but in point of fact, it's very good for your career to stay out of the media while you're with the Bureau. And I was completely accepting of that.
Yeah. I mean, kind of lets you do what you need to do. If you're all over there and your face is out there, they could find stuff on you. Terrorists could kind of do the reverse kind of thing, right?
Yeah, you don't want to be the story.
No.
You want to keep doing your job and helping other stories.
Was there ever a time you felt threatened, like your life was threatened?
No.
Never?
No. First of all, the bad guys know who I am. You live by your rules and respect theirs, then there's a certain amount of, for lack of a better term, professional courtesy.
Sure.
We had a prosecution in the early 90s. Against a bunch of Islamic terrorists. And the prosecutors in their court filings wrote a lot about Islam, and that rubbed some of them the wrong way. And we had a cooperating witness come in, and we flat out asked him, is anybody on our team under threat? And they didn't have any problem with any of the agents. But the guy pointed to one of the prosecutors and said, you need to be really careful because in your court filings, there was a lot of Islam in there.
Yeah.
And he didn't mean it to be that way, but that was the way they looked at it. So we, why am I laughing? We put protective details up around all the prosecutors. One of the guys, bring it, dude, Pat Fitzgerald. I don't know where Pat is these days. So we're sitting around, we're talking, and Pat's laughing. He says, you know, you got a covert surveillance team on me, and I step out of my house, go down to the local grocery store, and they're all 5 feet away from me, and there's a car following me, covert car, and it's literally driving down the street right next to me. He says, who do you think they're fooling? And I looked at him, I said, Pat, the last thing these guys want is to arrest the guy that killed you. And then he went, oh.
Yeah.
They want to make sure I don't get killed in the first place.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, it ain't a secret, Pat. Nobody wants.
It's not so covert after all.
Yeah, it's not covert at all.
It's right there. You got security detail.
For a guy, Pat Fitzgerald may be one of the smartest people I've ever met in my entire life. But for him to have missed that, you know, we gave him a hard time.
So interesting to me. Yeah, there was it Cat Stevens that said something about Islam? And they're like, we're going to take his head off. Or I do remember that a long time ago.
Cat Stevens converted to Islam.
Was it? Okay, then who was it that's, oh, Salman Rushdie.
Oh, yeah. Salman Rushdie's still on their list.
Is he still? He's not dead yet.
Yeah, well, okay. He's maybe... good, yeah, good for him.
So yeah, okay, so Cat Stevens converted and Salman Rushdie said something bad. Okay.
Yeah. He offended him, and I think he knew he was offending him. And most of Western society, that's the definition of a comedian, right?
Yeah, and it was the first time I ever heard about that, where you say something, it's just words, and somebody, I mean, really wants to kill you. Because you say something like that about Jesus Christ or God or, you know, you don't hear people saying, well, we're going to track you down and take your head off and then meaning it. So,
well, yeah. There have been some people come under threat over stuff that they've said and people thought were disrespectful of Jesus and God. It's just there's not as many of them seen in the Islamic religion. You're much more likely to set more people off. And they're understanding their rules again. You got to respect the other side's rules.
Sure. I mean, it makes sense. It does, especially when you have that high of a, people are so, they believe so much in what they're doing, and you start to say anything that's going to.
If you go into the wrong Italian neighborhood in New York City and start bad mouthing organized crime, I don't know you're going to last very long.
That's true. It's kind of scary. What do I say on this mic, too? It's like, you got to be careful. I've been censored, you know? It's like nobody's threatened to take my head off, but I say something somebody doesn't like. I've been censored. I got censored in 2012 for saying things or having a guest on that certain people didn't like.
Well, and also you got to go over the edge every now and then. I absolutely believe in going over the edge.
Oh, after that, I went way over the edge.
Excellent.
Oh, yeah, and I continued to. And then my...
Did you ever say something like Donald Trump has bad hair? Did you say something like that?
Never.
No?
No.
All right.
No. I haven't gone that far yet.
All right.
I haven't gone that far yet. It was somebody who'd done an expose on the IRS.
Oh.
It was called, his name was Aaron Russo, and it was a movie called Freedom to Fascism. America, Freedom to Fascism.
Uh-huh.
And we screened it, and every single person that wrote down that they were at the screening got audited. And my co-host was like, I'm out. She got audited. She was just like, I'm done. I'm done with this. And they were just certain things that were happening. And then we got the, I convinced her to stay, and then we got censored after we went to replay a show that this woman was on. I don't even want to say it because they'll probably not allow this on YouTube, but it was a woman that YouTube has banned and people have banned. And so she's like, I'm done. She's like, we went on air. I said, does anybody have this show? Does anybody have this show? Thousands of downloads. Not one person had it. It was gone off the Apple podcast. It was gone off my engineer's computer. It's gone off mine, completely gone. I saw her a couple of years ago. I said, hey, said, "You're the first time I ever got censored." 2012, I think it was. And she goes, "Yeah, sounds about right." Yeah, so lost my co-host on that one. Two of them. She got audited, and then we were censored, and she was done.
If you believe in your principles, every now and then something goes bad.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. I guess you're always going to come up against somebody who feels the exact opposite.
Right.
And maybe and they're bigger.
They don't want to take responsibility for their own life, and so.
There you go.
Hold somebody else accountable for their own failures.
There you go. Yeah. Okay, so tell me about your book, Never Split the Difference. You've had three books, right? Three or four books?
Yeah, four in total out
okay.
now. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
That my fingerprints are on.
Okay, so why Never Split the Difference?
It's always a bad idea. It's impossible to fairly, quote, use the F word, split the difference. Why is it impossible? Let's say you and I are apart $10. I get you to concede by $5 if I concede by $5. You're going to feel like that five is going to feel like 10. So you're going to be automatically unhappy. And you're not going to be happy again until you get the equivalent of 10 back.
Right.
A loss thinks twice as much as an equivalent gain. Daniel Kahneman, Nobel Prize in Behavioral Economics, 2002, Prospect Theory. So we're human. It's impossible to split the difference fairly because we're human. So that's where it starts. And then it just goes bad in all sorts of other directions between splitting the difference, the compromise. I'm listening to a Jeff Bezos interview not long ago, and he said, compromise is never about finding the truth. Never about finding the truth. So if you equate splitting the difference to compromise, and many people do, you're never getting at the truth. Now, do we find a way to collaborate so that the collaboration creates a greater sum? Like, I can't remember what elements comprise steel, but that's a collaboration of elements.
Sure.
That's some of this and some of that, not half of this and half of that. It's finding the right blend of ideas.
Yeah.
And so splitting the difference is not about finding the right blend. Splitting the difference is about being lazy. And by definition, it's not going to blend well because your blend is off. So whether it's splitting the difference or whether it's compromise, you're not coming up with the best outcome. You're guaranteeing suboptimal outcomes. And I don't believe in guaranteeing suboptimal outcomes.
So if you're not going to get what you want, if you're not going to get what you're negotiating for completely, do you just get out?
The only time we get out of negotiations all the time when the other person's a bad partner. Okay. So there's, it's not a sin to not get the deal. It's a sin to take a long time to not get the deal. Mm-hmm. It's also a sin to take a long time to get a bad deal because bad deals are very costly and expensive.
Yeah.
So a bad partner, I encourage we, in the first half hour, we're going to be able to figure out whether or not you're a good partner and we're out. Out, and we're not coming back. And that's been the hardest thing for the people that work for me, to know that I encourage them to withdraw very early to somebody who's a problem. And we're much more profitable as a result.
Yes. I've told that to people. I've done it myself. It took me a while to learn that. But get those people out of your life.
Right.
Get them out of your life, even if they're blood.
Yes.
I mean, I just cannot tell you how much better my life is, how much more happiness, how much more joy and success I have by getting these bad characters out of my life.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that they're like, they're not horrible people. They're just not your people.
Just
they're
a
not,
bad fit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or they don't, you know, it's like, I want somebody to stand with me, to stand behind me, to support me. You know, tell me the truth, you know, but don't criticize.
Right.
Work with me.
Right.
What are your ideas? You know, it's just very, very interesting what I have in my life now compared to 10 years ago.
Good
so
for you.
Different.
Yeah, yeah, good for you.
Thank
Excellent.
You. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a tough decision.
Yeah, it is.
And then when you see how much better your life can be, as soon as everybody, including blood, you decide whether or not your core values align, whether or not they're a good fit, whether or not they're on your side.
That's right. And when they're not, when you've, it took me a while to be betrayed. like over and over. And I went, okay, I'm done. I'm done. Thank you. I hope you have a wonderful life. I wish nothing. I truly, like, not even angry. I'm just like, I'm done. And I walk away. And it's like this heavy sack of rocks came off me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing.
Yep. Yeah. Agree completely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. You're fascinating. I could spend another hour with you, but maybe I'll have you back. But
I certainly look forward to that opportunity.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.